And when sworn, treated the committee to a series of dazzling grins, some of which clicked audibly. He pulled a typewritten statement from his pocket and read it with gusto. "In the first place," said Roosevelt, "I stand by my Baltimore report not only in its entirety, but paragraph by paragraph. It is absolutely impossible that my conclusions should be upset, for they are based upon the confessions of the accused persons made at the very time the events took place. It seems to me less a question of judgment in deciding on their guilt than it is a question of interpreting the English language as it is ordinarily used." He offered no apologies for his methods of investigation. "Of course I used leading questions. I have always used them in examinations of this kind, and always shall use them, to get to the truth." Having established his own position, Roosevelt turned to an analysis of Wanamaker's. Apparently, the Honorable Postmaster General, he used this phrase with heavy sarcasm no fewer than 18 times, put more faith in contradictory testimony, prepared after the fact with the help of lawyers, than in verbatim confessions recorded at the scene of the crime. "It is difficult for me to discuss seriously the proposition that a man, when questioned as to something which has just happened, will lie to his own hurt, and 6 months afterward tell the truth to his own benefit." He was glad the Honorable Postmaster General admitted there had been violations of the law in Baltimore during the last administration, but if the wrongdoing is not checked, it will be found at the end of 4 years to have been just as great under this administration. Roosevelt concluded, "I honestly fail to see how there can be a particle of question as to these men's guilt, after reading the evidence that is before you. And if these men are not guilty, then it is absolutely impossible that men ever can be guilty under the civil service law." Before adjournment, the committee voted a formal request for the Postmaster General's report. "Ah! I presume I shall be allowed to see that testimony?" said Roosevelt eagerly. When the chairman nodded assent, he was as delighted as a child. "Thanks! Thanks!" Delight changed to disgust as he read the text of the 900-page document. Wanamaker's inspectors had not been able to change the basic facts of the case. Much of the testimony, indeed, was even more incriminating than before. But they blatantly ignored this evidence in presenting their conclusions. Commissioner Roosevelt, the report declared, had been malicious, unfair, and partial in the extreme in his investigation, determined to deceive or mislead witnesses for some political purpose. Roosevelt reacted to these slurs with a dignity that merely emphasized the depths of his anger. He sent a registered letter to Wanamaker saying that the post office inspectors had cast reflections not only on his actions, but on his motives. "There is no need in commenting on their gross impertinence and impropriety," Roosevelt wrote. "Used as they are by the subordinates of one department in reference to one of the heads of another, who is, like yourself, responsible to the president only. But I have nothing to do with these subordinates. It is with you, the official head, responsible for their action, that I have to deal. By submitting this report without expressly disclaiming any responsibility for it, you seem to assume that responsibility and make it your own. I can hardly suppose this was your intention, but I shall be obliged to treat these statements, which in any way reflect on my acts and motives, as yours, unless you disavow them with the same publicity with which they were made to the committee. I therefore respectfully ask you whether you will or will not make such disavowal, so that I may govern myself accordingly and not be guilty of any injustice." Roosevelt waited 9 days, but Wanamaker made no reply. On 25 May, therefore, he appeared at a final session of the investigating committee with a typewritten statement under his athletic arm and fire in his eye. He began by reading his letter to Wanamaker, to the sound of excited scribbling in the press gallery. Then, in a lucid analysis of the two masses of evidence gathered in Baltimore by himself and Wanamaker's inspectors, he showed that at least 2/3 of the latter was even more damaging than his own. Yet Wanamaker had ignored this evidence in favor of the remaining third, which had obviously been gathered with intent to whitewash. "I have never sheltered myself behind my subordinates," said Roosevelt loftily, "and I decline to let the Postmaster General shelter himself behind his." He would not accuse Wanamaker of an official cover-up, but if the investigation in which this testimony was taken had been made with the deliberate intent of shielding the accused, covering up their wrongdoing, and attempting to perjure themselves so that the post office could be cleared from the effect of their former truthful confessions, it would have been managed precisely as it actually was managed. In conclusion, Roosevelt noted that the Postmaster General was in the habit of saying he cherished nothing but goodwill toward the Civil Service Commission. I regret to say that I must emphatically dissent from this statement. Many of his actions during the past 2 years seem to be explicable only on the ground of dislike of the Commission and of willingness to hamper its work. It was a masterly performance. Roosevelt kept tight rein over his temper, let the facts speak for themselves, and stepped from the stand with an air of complete self-assurance. The reaction of the editors of the New York Times next morning typified that of honest men across the nation. We do not remember an instance in the history of our government in which an officer of the government, appointed by the president and charged with independent duties of a most responsible and important character, has felt called upon to go before a congressional committee and submit to its statements so damaging to the character of another officer of the government of still higher rank. Nor do we see how Mr. Roosevelt could have refused to do what he has done. He has been forced to it, and by conduct on the part of Mr. Wanamaker that is entirely inexcusable and without any decent motive. It may be said that Mr. Roosevelt has taken upon himself to accuse Mr. Wanamaker of what amounts to untruthfulness. That is not a pleasing position to be occupied by a gentleman who is a cabinet officer and a person of conspicuous pretensions to piety. But Mr. Roosevelt showed that Mr. Wanamaker had adopted and acted on statements that he knew were false, that he bore himself generally with a curious mingling of smug impertinence and cowardice. The exposure he has suffered from Mr. Roosevelt is merciless and humiliating, but it is clearly deserved. The majority report of the investigating committee, dated 22 June, used even stronger language. It described Wanamaker's testimony as evasive and garbled, and said he was clearly in desperate straits. The Postmaster General's extraordinary failure to act in the Baltimore case indicated either a determination not to enforce the law or negligence therein to the last degree. As for the testimony taken by his inspectors, it confirmed and corroborated fully that taken in the original investigation. The righteousness of the law was upheld, and Theodore Roosevelt could enjoy the sweetest political triumph of his career as commissioner. The story of the rest of the Harrison administration can be briefly told. At 3:20 a.m., on the morning after the investigating committee filed the above-quoted report, Grover Cleveland was renominated by the Democrats for President of the United States. This news, coinciding as it did with the public disgrace of John Wanamaker and reports of scandalous use of patronage in the renomination of Benjamin Harrison at Minneapolis, came as a signal for all disillusioned reformers to desert the Republican Party, as they had in 1884. Although memories of office looting under the Democrats still lingered, they were neither as recent nor as disturbing as those publicized by the Republican Civil Service Commissioner. "Poor Harrison," remarked the New York Sun. "If he has erred, he has been punished. The irrepressible, belligerent, and enthusiastic Roosevelt has made him suffer, and has more suffering in store for him." Actually, Roosevelt ceased to pester the little general through the campaign of 1892, possibly because he knew Mrs. Harrison was dying of tuberculosis. In July, he wrote a long, flattering article, "The Foreign Policy of President Harrison," for publication in the 11 August issue of The Independent. Although the policy in question was largely that of Secretary of State James G. Blaine, Roosevelt's conclusion, "No other administration since the Civil War has made so excellent a record in its management of our foreign relations," could not but have gratified his melancholy chief. Roosevelt enjoyed a renewed burst of literary activity that summer, publishing at least four other major articles on subjects ranging from Anglomania to political assessments. He also forced himself to read all of Chaucer, whose lustier lyrics had hitherto made him gag. Even now, he found such tales as The Summoners altogether needlessly filthy, but he confessed to enjoying the others. He exercised strenuously to work off the effects of a sedentary winter, galloping through the woods around Washington with Lodge, playing tennis at the British Legation, and whacking polo balls around the green fields of Long Island. "I tell you, a corpulent middle-aged literary man finds a stiff polo match rather good exercise." At the beginning of August, Roosevelt left to go west as usual, but official engagements in South Dakota permitted him only a week or two in the Badlands. He was not sorry to leave Elkhorn, for game was scarce and the empty cabin depressed him. Hell-roaring Bill Jones agreed to drive him south to Deadwood, with Sylvain Ferris as a companion. This trip gave Roosevelt the opportunity to luxuriate in cowboy conversation, of which he had been starved in recent years. On 25 August, the wagon rolled into Deadwood, and Roosevelt soon discovered that, in spite of his sunburn and rough garb, he was regarded as a visiting celebrity. This was due more, perhaps, to his fame as the captor of Redhead Finnegan than to any relationship with the current administration. A deputation of citizens waited upon him at his hotel and announced that a mass meeting had been scheduled in his honor that evening. At the appointed hour, a band escorted him willy-nilly to the Deadwood Opera House, where he was obliged to open President Harrison's local re-election campaign. There was no point in protesting that as civil service commissioner, he was not supposed to take sides in a political contest. Local comprehension of his title was typified by the sheriff of the Black Hills, who remarked genially, "Well, anything civil goes with me." He spent the next month on a tedious but important tour of the neighboring Indian reservations. The dusty hopelessness of those sprawling communities seems to have wrought a profound change in his attitude to the American Indian. During his years as a rancher, Roosevelt had acquired plenty of anti-Indian prejudice, strangely at odds with his enlightened attitude to blacks. But his research into the great Indian military heroes for the winning of the West had done much to moderate this. Now, touring Pine Ridge and Crow Creek on behalf of the Great White Father, he looked on the red man not as an adversary, but as a ward of the state, whom it was his duty to protect. Pity, not unmixed with honte de vainqueur, flared into anger when he discovered that even here, in decaying federal agencies and fly-blown schools, the spoil system was an accepted part of the government. Clerks and teachers testified they were routinely assessed for amounts up to $200 per head by the South Dakota Republican Central Committee, on pain of losing their jobs. Any time now, the collectors would be around to seek contributions for President Harrison. Roosevelt promptly called a press conference in Sioux City and blasted the infamy of meanness that would rob women and Indians of their meager wages. He demanded the prosecution of several high Republican officials and announced that Indians in the classified service need not contribute a penny to any future assessments. The wretchedness he saw at Pine Ridge stayed with him long after he returned east. In a speech summing up his career as civil service commissioner under President Harrison, Roosevelt sounded a note of human compassion rare in his early public utterances. "Here we have a group of beings who are not able to protect themselves. We're groping toward civilization out of the darkness of heredity and ingrained barbarism, and to whom, theoretically, we are supposed to be holding out a helping hand. They are utterly unable to protect themselves. They are credulous and easily duped by a bad agent, and they are susceptible of remarkable improvement when the agent is a good man, thoroughly efficient and thoroughly practical. To the Indians, the workings of the spoil system at the agencies is a curse and an outrage. It must mean that the painful road leading upward from savagery is rendered infinitely more difficult and infinitely more stony for the poor feet trying to tread it." On 25 October 1892, 2 days before Roosevelt's 34th birthday, Mrs. Benjamin Harrison died, adding a final touch of doom to the moribund Republican campaign. The little general had not wanted to be renominated, and now, as grief crippled him, he wanted even less to be reelected. Privately, he longed to go back to Indianapolis, but a Harrison never runs away from a fight. On 8 November, however, his wish for retirement was granted. Grover Cleveland returned to power with a 3% majority, thanks to the swing of the reform vote. "Well, as to the general result, I am disappointed, but not surprised," Roosevelt wrote Lodge. "But how it galls to see the self-complacent triumph of our foes." What probably galled him even more, although he did not say it, was the thought that Lodge, who had scored a personal coup in the Massachusetts election, was now in line for a seat in the U.S. Senate, while he would soon have to pack up his bags and return to Sagamore Hill. A few newspapers wanted him to be reappointed, but it was unlikely the Democrats would favor a civil service commissioner who had attacked President Cleveland so sharply in the past. He could scarcely have survived even if Harrison had won. Since the Wanamaker affair, Republican spoilsmen had been insisting, in swarms, that Roosevelt must go. "I have the profound gratification of knowing that there is no man more bitterly disliked by many of the men in my own party," he told a fellow reformer. "When I leave on March 5th, I shall at least have the knowledge that I have certainly not flinched from trying to enforce the law during these 4 years, even if my progress has been at times a little disheartening." Another death shook him on 7 December and plunged the whole family into official mourning. Anna Roosevelt, her frail health broken by 2 years of humiliation, succumbed to diphtheria at the age of 29. The last message to Elliot in Virginia was a telegraphed, "Do not come." One wonders if this gave any momentary pang to Theodore, who more than anyone else was responsible for their separation. During its last few months in power, the Harrison administration was possessed of immortal longings. A robe and a crown, of sorts, became available in the Pacific, and the president hastened to put them on. They belonged to Queen Liliuokalani of Hawaii, who early in the new year had proclaimed a policy of Hawaii for the Hawaiians in an attempt to end half a century of economic domination by the United States. She was immediately deposed in an uprising of native sugar growers, aided by some American Marines, and abetted by the American minister. Within weeks, representatives of the revolutionaries arrived in Washington to negotiate a treaty of annexation. President Harrison complied, although it was unlikely the incoming Democratic administration would allow the document to get very far in Congress. Washington society, meanwhile, embraced Hawaii as the theme of the season. Hostesses served lavish luaus to their guests, to the wine of native guitars. Fashionable couples, hurrying in furs from one party to another, hummed the latest hit, a serenade to the deposed island queen. "Come, Liliuokalani, give Uncle Sam your little yellow honey." Henry Adams proudly introduced the latest addition to his circle, a 400-pound Polynesian chief named Tati Salmon. "A polished gentleman," Roosevelt noted approvingly, "of easy manners, with an interesting undertone of queer barbarism." As the season wore on, a delicious fragrance filled the air, of pineapples and Pacific ozone, of warm, dusky flesh and spices. It was the smell of empire, and none sniffed it more eagerly than Roosevelt. With all his soul, he longed to remain in Washington, where the future of his country was blossoming like some brilliant tropical flower. Amazingly, it seemed that the president-elect bore him no grudge and might invite him to stay on as civil service commissioner. Benjamin F. Tracy, outgoing Secretary of the Navy, urged him to accept, and in doing so, bestowed a compliment which delighted Roosevelt more than any other he had ever received. "Well, my boy," said Tracy, "you have been a thorn in our side during 4 years. I earnestly hope that you will remain to be a thorn in the side of the next administration." Chapter 18. The Universe Spinner. Force rules the world still, has ruled it, shall rule it. Meekness is weakness. Strength is triumphant.
"We have built these splendid edifices," roared Grover Cleveland. "But we have also built the magnificent fabric of a popular government, whose grand proportions are seen throughout the world."
His eyes flickered back and forth. He was trying to read his notes, seek out an ivory button, and address 200,000 people simultaneously. The eyes of the crowd, too, were restless. They shifted from the president's fat forefinger, as it hovered over the button, to the inert fountains, the furled flags, the motionless wheels in the Palace of Mechanic Arts, and the enshrouded statue looming against the fog banks of Lake Michigan.
"As by a touch the machinery that gives life to this vast exposition is now set in motion, so at the same instant let our hopes and aspirations awaken forces which in time to come—"
Maestro Thomas raised his baton over 700 musicians, and for the first moment that morning a hush descended on the grand court.
"Shall influence the welfare, the dignity, and the freedom of mankind," Cleveland intoned, and pressed the button.
It was 8 minutes past noon, Chicago time, on 1 May, 1893. From the flagstaff crowning the gold-domed administration building, 300 feet above the president's head, Old Glory broke forth, a split second before the lower banners of Christopher Columbus and Spain. 700 other ensigns exploded brilliantly over the White City. The great Alice engine coughed into life, and 7,000 feet of shafting began to move. Fountains gushed so high that umbrellas popped up everywhere, and the folds fell from the statue of the Republic, revealing a gilt goddess facing west, her arms extended toward the frontier. The noise accompanying this cataclysmic moment, the first demonstration on a massive scale of the generative powers of electricity, was appropriately tremendous. From the lake came the thunder of naval artillery and the shriek of countless steam whistles. Carillons pealed, the orchestra crashed out Handel's Hallelujah Chorus, and louder than everything else rose the roaring of the crowd. The war whooping of 75 Sioux added savage overtones. This bedlam continued for 10 full minutes. Then America sounded on massed trombones, and the roaring turned to singing. Even the stolid Cleveland was moved to join in, to the embarrassment of his guest of honor, Cristobal Duke of Aragua, Columbus's senior living descendant. The little Spaniard stood bowed under the weight of his inherited epaulets, silent in the universal chorus. Let music swell the breeze, and ring from all the trees, sweet freedom's song. Theodore Roosevelt did not arrive in Chicago for another 10 days. His own modest contribution to the World's Fair was a Boone and Crockett Club cabin, dedicated 15 May. But he had little need of music and artillery to swell his love of country. Indeed, this stupendous exposition, whose combination of classical architecture and modern technology so bewildered Henry Adams that he felt the universe was tottering, was to Roosevelt an entirely natural and logical product of American civilization. He was conventionally moved by its grandeur, the most beautiful architectural exhibit the world has ever seen. But the fair by no means matched the splendor of his own dreams for America. These palaces, after all, were carved out of plaster and would survive at most for a couple of seasons. His Columbia would burgeon for centuries. To Adams, sitting with spinning head on the steps of the administration building, the World's Fair asked for the first time whether the American people knew where they were driving. He suspected they did not, but that they might still be driving or drifting unconsciously to some point in thought, as their solar system was said to be drifting toward some point in space, and that possibly, if relations enough could be observed, this point might be fixed. Chicago was the first expression of American thought as a unity. One must start there. Roosevelt felt no need to ask or answer such questions. He had long known exactly where the United States was drifting, just as he had throughout life known where he was driving. He came to the White City, gazed cheerfully upon it, then hurried off to Indianapolis on Civil Service Commission business. There was no need to stop and ponder the dynamos, the new powers, which so mystified Henry Adams, for he felt their energy whirring within himself. Theodore Roosevelt, as the British MP John Morley later observed, was America. The America that grew to maturity after the Civil War, marshaled its resources at Chicago, and exploded into world power at the turn of the century. Grover Cleveland's adjectives on opening day, splendid, magnificent, grand, vast, were no different from those Roosevelt himself had lavished on America in all his books. The symbolism of the flags and of the little Spanish admiral dwarfed by a 300-pound American president was pleasing to him, but not revelatory. 9 years before, in his 4th of July oration to the Cowboys of Dickinson, he had hoped to see the day when not a foot of American soil will be held by any European power. And instinct told him that that day was fast approaching. When it came, it would bring out what some consider the best, what others consider the worst in him. This overriding impulse has been given many names: jingoism, nationalism, imperialism, chauvinism, even fascism and racism. Roosevelt preferred to use the simple and to him beautiful word, Americanism. The winning of the West, which occupied Roosevelt on and off for nearly 9 years, was the first comprehensive statement of his Americanism, and by extension, since he was America, of himself. All his previous books had been, in a sense, sketches for this one, just as his subsequent books were postscripts to it, of diminishing historical and psychological interest. One by one, themes he had touched on in the past came up for synthesis and review. The importance of naval preparedness and effect of ethnic derivations on fighting blood, the Naval War of 1812. The identity of Native Americans with their own flora and fauna, hunting trips of a ranchman. The doctrine of manifest destiny, Thomas Hart Benton. The need for law and order in a savage environment, ranch life and the hunting trail. The significance of the United States Constitution, Gouverneur Morris. The problems of free government, essays in practical politics, and the social dynamics of immigration, New York. Nothing written prior to Roosevelt's presidency shows the breadth of his mind to greater advantage than the introduction to the Winning of the West, which makes it clear that his specific subject, white settlement of Indian lands west of the Alleghenies in the late 18th century, is but a chapter in the unfolding of an epic racial saga covering thousands of years and millions of square miles. The erudition with which he traces the perfectly continuous history of Anglo-Saxons from the days of King Alfred to those of George Washington is impressive. He draws effortless parallels between the romanticization of the Celto-Iberians in the 2nd century BC and the capture of Mexico and Peru by the conquistadores. Between the Punic Wars and the War of the American Revolution, even between the future of whites in South Africa and the fate of Greek colonists in the Tauric Chersonese. During the past 3 centuries, Roosevelt begins, the spread of the English-speaking peoples over the world's waste spaces has been not only the most striking feature in the world's history, but also the event of all others most far-reaching in its importance. What else but destiny, a destiny yet to be fully realized, can explain the remorseless advance of Anglo-Saxon civilization? The language of what was, in Queen Elizabeth's time, a relatively unimportant insular kingdom, now holds sway over worlds whose endless coasts are washed by the waves of 3 great oceans. Never in history has a race expanded over so wide an area in so short a time. And the winning of the American West may be counted as the crowning and greatest achievement of that mighty movement. The narrative proper begins in Chapter 6 with the first trickle of settlement following Daniel Boone's penetration of the Cumberland Gap in 1765. Roosevelt uses a striking flood metaphor. The American backwoodsmen had surged up, wave upon wave, till their mass trembled in the troughs of the Alleghenies, ready to flood the continent beyond. As the flood gathers volume, he achieves the effect of ever-widening waves by making his chapters overlap, every one moving farther afield geographically and further ahead in time. So intoxicated is Roosevelt as he rides these waves that he sweeps uncaring past such solid obstructions as institutional analysis and land company proceedings. I have always been more interested in the men themselves than the institutions through which they worked, he confessed. He might have added, and in action rather than theory. Far and away, the best parts of the Winning of the West are the fighting chapters. In describing border battles, Roosevelt reveals himself with the utter unself-consciousness which was always part of his charm. He makes no secret of his boyish identification with those gaunt, fierce warriors of the frontier, who were strong and simple, powerful for good and evil, swayed by gusts of stormy passion, the love of freedom rooted in their very heart's core. Here is Roosevelt the aggressor, single-handedly killing or crippling 7 Indians in the pitch darkness of his pioneer log cabin, wrenching himself from the stake and running naked for 5 days through mosquito country, trying consecutively to shoot, knife, throttle, and drown a reluctant Chief Bigfoot, while his own brother puts a bullet in his back, advancing upon Vincennes through mile after mile of freezing, waist-deep water, and in a moment of supreme ecstasy, spurring a white horse over a sheer 300-foot cliff. There was a crash, the shock of a heavy body, half-springing, half-falling, a scramble among loose rocks, and the snapping of saplings and bushes. And in another moment, the awe-struck Indians above saw their unarmed foe galloping his white horse in safety across the plain. Here, too, is Roosevelt the righteous, assailing the warped, perverse, and silly morality that would preserve the American continent for the use of a few scattered savage tribes whose life was but a few degrees less meaningless, squalid, and ferocious than that of the wild beasts with whom they held joint ownership. He pours scorn on selfish and indolent Easterners who fail to see the race importance of the work done by Western pioneers. Yet Roosevelt is not sentimental about the latter. He shows the tendency of the frontier to barbarize both conqueror and conquered until such civilized issues as good versus evil, law versus anarchy, are forgotten in the age-old struggle of man against man. It is a primeval warfare, and it is waged as war was waged in the ages of bronze and iron. All the merciful humanity that even war has gained during the last 2,000 years is lost. It is a warfare where no pity is shown to non-combatants, where the weak are harried without ruth, and the vanquished are maltreated with merciless ferocity. A sad and evil feature of such warfare is that the whites, the representatives of civilization, speedily sink almost to the level of their barbarous foes in point of hideous brutality. Yet, says Roosevelt, this kind of struggle is elemental in its consequences to the future of the world. In a paragraph which will return to haunt him, he proclaims, "The most ultimately righteous of all wars is a war with savages, though it is apt to be also the most terrible and inhuman. The rude, fierce settler who drove the savage from the land lays all civilized mankind under a debt to him. American and Indian, Boer and Zulu, Cossack and Tartar, New Zealander and Maori. In each case, the victor, horrible though many of his deeds are, has laid deep the foundations for the future greatness of a mighty people. It is of incalculable importance that America, Australia, and Siberia should pass out of the hands of their red, black, and yellow aboriginal owners and become the heritage of the dominant world races." Roosevelt the Proud saw no reason to retract this passage in later life, for the overall context of the winning of the West makes plain that he regarded any such race struggle as ephemeral. Once civilization was established, the Aborigine must be raised and refined as quickly as possible so that he may partake of every opportunity available to the master race. In other words, become master of himself, free to challenge and beat the white man in any field of endeavor. Nothing could give Roosevelt more satisfaction than to see such a reversal, for he admired individual achievement above all things. Any black or red man who could win admission to the fellowship of the doers was superior to the white man who failed. Roosevelt's long-term dream was nothing more or less than the general, steady self-betterment of the multicolored American nation. Of Roosevelt the military man, as revealed in The Winning of the West, little need be said. Chapter after chapter, volume after volume, demonstrates his ability to analyze the motives that drive men to battle, to define the mysterious powers of leadership and weigh the relative strengths of armies. His accounts of the Battle of King's Mountain and the defeat of St. Clair are so full of visual and auditory detail and exhibit such an uncanny sense of terrain that it is hard to believe the author himself has never felt the shock of arms. One can only infer from the power and brilliance of the prose that such passages are the sublimation of his most intense desires, and that until he can charge, like Colonel William Campbell, up an enemy-held ridge at the head of 1,000 wiry horse riflemen, he will never be fulfilled. Roosevelt was not alone in his efforts during the early 1890s to define and explore the origins of Americanism. Long before the final volume of The Winning of the West was published, other young intellectuals took up and developed his theme that the true American identity was to be found only in the West. The most brilliant of these was Frederick Jackson Turner, who came to the Chicago World's Fair in July 1893 to deliver his seminal address, The Significance of the Frontier in American History, before an audience of aging, puzzled academics. Turner had admiringly reviewed Roosevelt's first two volumes in 1889, and had marked in his personal copy a passage describing the true significance of the vast movement by which this continent was conquered and peopled. His thesis, that the existence of an area of free land, its continuous recession, and the advancement of American settlement westward explain American development, was identical with that of The Winning of the West, albeit expressed more succinctly. But Turner refined away much of the crudity of Roosevelt's ethnic thinking. It was not blood, but environment that made the American frontiersman unique. He was shaped by the challenge of his situation at the meeting point between savagery and civilization. Forced continually to adapt himself to new dangers and new opportunities as the frontier moved west, he was Americanized at a much quicker rate than the sedentary European-influenced Easterner. Consequently, said Turner, It was to the frontier that the American intellect owes its most striking characteristics. And in listing those characteristics, Turner painted an accurate portrait of somebody not unfamiliar to readers of this biography. That coarseness and strength combined with acuteness and inquisitiveness, that practical, inventive turn of mind, quick to find expedients, that masterful grasp of material things, lacking in the artistic, but powerful to effect great ends, that restless, nervous energy, that dominant individualism, working for good and evil, and with all that buoyancy which comes with freedom, these are the traits of the frontier. Turner closed his great essay on an elegiac note. The Chicago World's Fair marked more than the 400th anniversary of the arrival of Columbus in the New World. It coincidentally marked the end of the era of free land. An obscure government pamphlet had recently announced that since the frontier was now almost completely broken up by settlements, it cannot any longer have a place in the census reports. This apparently unnoticed sentence, said Turner, made it clear that the United States had reached the limits of its natural expansion. Yet what of American energy continually demanding a wider field for its exercise? Turner did not dare answer that question. All he knew was the frontier was gone, and with its going has closed the first period of American history. Theodore Roosevelt was not among Turner's drowsy audience that hot summer's day, but he was one of the first historians to sense the revolutionary qualities of the thesis when it was published early in 1894. "I think you have struck some first-class ideas," he wrote enthusiastically, "and have put into definite shape a good deal of thought which has been floating around rather loosely." This was hardly the profound scholarly praise which Turner craved, but the older man's warmth and his promise to quote the thesis in Volume 3 of The Winning of the West, of course making full acknowledgement, was flattering. Turner thus became yet another addition to the circle of Roosevelt's academic admirers, and a fascinated observer of his later career. If one could no longer see the frontier retreat, one could have fun watching Theodore advance. Roosevelt spent much of his time during the years 1893 to 95 formulating theories of Americanism, partly under the influence of Turner, but mostly under the influence of his own avidly eclectic reading. Gradually, the theories coalesced into a philosophy embracing practically every aspect of American life, from warfare to wildflowers. He began to publish patriotic articles with titles like What Americanism Means, and continued to write such pieces with undiminished fervor for the rest of his life. In addition, he preached the gospel of Americanism ad nauseam at every public or private opportunity. 99% of the millions of words he thus poured out are sterile, banal, and so droningly repetitive as to defeat the most dedicated researcher. There is no doubt that on this subject, Theodore Roosevelt was one of the bores of all ages. The wonder is that during his lifetime so many men, women, and children worshipfully pondered every platitude. Here is an example taken from the above-named essay. "We Americans have many grave problems to solve, many threatening evils to fight, and many deeds to do if, as we hope and believe, we have the wisdom, the strength, and the courage and the virtue to do them. But we must face facts as they are. We must neither surrender ourselves to a foolish optimism, nor succumb to a timid and ignoble pessimism." And so on, and so on. Once Roosevelt got a good, balanced rhythm going, he could continue indefinitely until his listeners, or his column inches, were exhausted. An analysis of What Americanism Means discloses that even when dealing with what is presumably a positive subject, Roosevelt's instinct is to express himself negatively, to attack un-Americans rather than praise all Americans. Imprecations hurled at the former outnumber adjectives of praise for the latter almost 10-1. Selecting at random, we find base, low, selfish, silly, evil, noxious, despicable, unwholesome, shameful, flaccid, contemptible, together with a plentiful sprinkling of pejorative nouns, weaklings, hypocrites, demagogues, fools, renegades, criminals, idiots, anarchists. One marvels at the copious flow of his invective, especially as the victims of it are not identified. It is possible, however, to single out Henry James, that miserable little snob whose preference for English society and English literature drove Roosevelt to near frenzy. Thus, it is for the undersized man of letters, who flees his country because he, with his delicate, effeminate sensitiveness, finds the conditions of life on this side of the water crude and raw. In other words, because he finds that he cannot play a man's part among men, and so goes where he will be sheltered from the winds that harden stouter souls. In such manner did Roosevelt, with the shrewd instinct of a rampant heterosexual, kick James again and again in his obscure hurt until the novelist was moved to weary protest. The national consciousness for Mr. Theodore Roosevelt is, at the best, a very fierce affair. James was too courteous to say more in print, but he privately characterized Roosevelt as a dangerous and ominous jingo, and the mere monstrous embodiment of unprecedented and resounding noise. It is a relief to turn from Roosevelt's own spontaneous essays to those prompted by the philosophizing of others, notably the English historian Charles H. Pearson, whose National Life and Character, A Forecast, appeared in early 1894. Roosevelt wrote a 10,000-word reply to this work of gentle, scholarly pessimism for publication in the May issue of Sewanee Review. It represents altogether the better side of him, both as a man and as a writer, and can be taken as his confident answer to those who, like Pearson and Henry Adams, shuddered at the nearness of the 20th century. "At no period of the world's history," says Roosevelt, "has life been so full of interest and of possibilities of excitement and enjoyment. Science has revolutionized industry. Darwin has revolutionized thought. The globe's waste spaces are being settled and seeded. A man of ambition has unique opportunities to build, explore, conquer, and transform. He can taste the fearful joy of grappling with large political and administrative problems. If he is observant, he notes all around him the play of vaster forces than have ever before been exerted, working half blindly, half under control, to bring about immeasurable results." Roosevelt refuses to look at the future through the dun-colored mists of pessimism. Yet he does not pretend to see it all clearly. "Nevertheless, signs do not fail that we shall see the conditions of our lives, national and individual, modified after a sweeping and radical fashion. Many of the forces that make for national greatness and for individual happiness in the 19th century will be absent entirely, or will act with greatly diminished strength in the 20th. Many of the forces that now make for evil will by that time have gained greatly in volume and power." Pearson's theory that the higher races cannot long subjugate black and brown majorities finds Roosevelt in complete agreement, for men of our stock do not prosper in tropical countries. Only in thinly peopled, temperate regions is there any lasting hope for European civilization. A secure future is promised the English-speaking conquerors of North America and Australia, as well as the Russians, who, by a movement which has not yet fired the popular imagination, but which thinking men recognize as of incalculable importance, are building up a vast state in northern Asia. But Europeans, hoping to live and propagate permanently in the hot regions of India and Africa, are doomed. In one of the earliest of his many remarkable flights of historical prophecy, flawed only by an exaggerated time scale, he writes, "The Greek rulers of Bactria were ultimately absorbed and vanished, as probably the English rulers of India will someday in the future, for the good of mankind we sincerely hope and believe in the very remote future, themselves be absorbed and vanish. In Africa south of the Zambezi, and possibly here and there on high plateaus north of it, there may remain white states, although even these states will surely contain a large colored population, always threatening to swamp the whites. It is almost impossible that they will not, in the end, succeed in throwing off the yoke of the European outsiders, though this end may be, and we hope will be, many centuries distant. In America, most of the West Indies are becoming Negro islands. It is impossible for the dominant races of the temperate zones ever bodily to displace the peoples of the tropics." Roosevelt is serenely untroubled by Pearson's fear that the black and yellow races of the world will one day attain great economic and military power and threaten their erstwhile masters. "By that time, the descendant of the Negro may be as intellectual as the Athenian. We shall then simply be dealing with another civilized nation of non-Aryan blood, precisely as we now deal with Magyar, Finn, and Basque." Turning from global to national matters, Roosevelt discusses the phenomenon of the stationary state, in which a freely developing nation tends to become rigid and authoritarian as its period of upward mobility comes to an end. But again, he sees no cause for concern. It is right and proper that the power of government should increase to counteract the mercilessness of private commercial warfare. As for that other tendency of a maturing civilization, the crowding out of the upper class by the middle and lower, Roosevelt welcomes it as he welcomes all natural processes. Every new generation, he says, will increase the proportion of mechanics, workmen, and farmers to that of scientists, statesmen, and poets, but as long as the aggregate population increases, there will be no decline in cultural values. On the contrary, the nation's overall quality will improve, thanks to the transmission of acquired characters by an ever-thinning, ever-refining aristocracy. This process in every civilization operates so strongly as to counterbalance that baleful law of natural selection which tells against the survival of the most desirable classes. Reducing his focus yet again to the domestic environment, Roosevelt heartily disagrees with Pearson's mistrust of Americanized democratic families. "To all who have known really happy family lives," he writes, "that is, to all who have known or who have witnessed the greatest happiness which there can be on this earth, it is hardly necessary to say that the highest idea of the family is attainable only where the father and mother stand to each other as lovers and friends. In these homes, the children are bound to father and mother by ties of love, respect, and obedience, which are simply strengthened by the fact that they are treated as reasonable beings with rights of their own, and that the rule of the household is changed to suit the changing years as childhood passes into manhood and womanhood." Roosevelt is making no effort to be metaphorical, but this whole simple and beautiful passage may be taken as symbolic of his attitude to his country and the world. Father is strength in the home, just as government is strength in America, and America is, or ought to be, strength overseas. Mother represents upbringing, education, the spread of civilization. Children are the lower classes, the lower races, to be brought to maturity and then set free. "We do not agree," Roosevelt concludes, "that there is a day approaching when the lower races will predominate in the world, and the higher races will have lost their noblest elements. On the whole, we think that the greatest victories are yet to be won, the greatest deeds yet to be done. The one plain duty of every man is to face the future as he faces the present, regardless of what it may have in store for him, turning toward the light as he sees the light, to play his part manfully as a man among men." Roosevelt was certainly playing his own part manfully when he wrote the above lines in the early spring of 1894. His intellectual activity was as intense as it had ever been. Having published in late 1893 The Wilderness Hunter, the third of his great nature trilogy and arguably his finest book, he was now simultaneously at work on volumes 3 and 4 of The Winning of the West, planning the never-to-be-written volumes 5 and 6, editing his second Boone and Crockett Club anthology, to which he also contributed scholarly articles, reading Kipling, and addressing a variety of correspondence on subjects ranging from British court procedures to arboreal distinctions between northern and southern mammalian species. In addition, he had recently begun a part-time career as a professional lecturer, and took frequent quick trips out of town to speak in New York or Boston on history, hunting, municipal politics, and the subject on which I feel deepest, U.S. foreign policy. There was a reason for all this activity, abnormal even by his standards. During the previous summer, Grover Cleveland had presided unhappily over the worst financial panic in American history, a crisis so severe as to make the plaster palaces of Chicago seem but hollow symbols indeed. The nation's steady outflow of gold, caused by a steady rise in imports and monthly purchases of silver by the government, mandatory since the Silver Purchase Act of 1890, could only be stopped by drastic action, and Cleveland had summoned an emergency session of Congress on 7 August 1893. Despite violent opposition from his own party, the president managed to force the repeal of the controversial act on 28 August. He thus saved the nation's credit, but transformed himself overnight into the most unpopular president since James Buchanan. Americans high and low felt the icy threat of bankruptcy that winter, and Roosevelt, still striving vainly to recover from his losses in Dakota, was no exception. His accounts showed a crippling deficit of $2,500 in December 1893. Edith, in her private letters, put the total nearer $3,000. Roosevelt complained that his ill-paid government job was not the right career for a man without means. The sale of 6 acres of property on Sagamore Hill at $400 apiece brought him temporary security, but Roosevelt knew he would still have to scrabble for freelance pennies during the next few years in order to save his home and educate his children. The birth of a son, Archibald Bullock, on 10 April 1894, was further cause for concern. "I begin to think that this particular branch of the Roosevelt family is getting to be numerous enough." Although he professed still to be enjoying his work as civil service commissioner and to get on beautifully with the president, an increasing restlessness through the spring and summer of 1894 is palpable in his correspondence. It would be needlessly repetitive to describe the battles he fought for reform under Cleveland, for they were essentially the same as those he fought under Harrison. "As far as my work is concerned," he grumbled, "the two administrations are much of a muchness. There were the same mean, sneaky little acts of petty spoilsmongering in government, the same looting of federal offices across the nation, which Roosevelt combated with his usual weapons of publicity and aggressive investigation, the same pleas for extra funds and extra staff. We are now in all 5,000 papers behind. The same fiery reports and 5,000-word letters bombarding members of Congress. The same obstinate lobbying at the White House for extensions of the classified service. The same compulsive attacks upon porcine opponents, such as Assistant Secretary of State Josiah P. Quincy, hunting for patronage as a pig hunts truffles, and Secretary of the Interior Hoke Smith, with his twinkling little green pig's eyes. All this, of course, meant that Roosevelt was having fun. As Cecil Spring Rice remarked, "Teddy is consumed with energy as long as he is doing something and fighting somebody. He always finds something to do and somebody to fight. Poor Cabot must be successful. While Teddy is happiest when he conquers, but quite happy if he only fights." He continued utterly to dominate the Civil Service Commission, not without some protest on the part of General George D. Johnston, Hugh Thompson's old and crotchety successor. On several occasions, their altercations grew so violent that Roosevelt said only a sense of propriety restrained him from going down among the spittoons with the general. Things became dangerous when Johnston, who wore a pistol at all times, objected to Roosevelt's office being carpeted before his. Roosevelt had a private talk with President Cleveland, and the general was offered 2 remote diplomatic posts, in Vancouver and Siam. He refused both, whereupon Cleveland summarily removed him. This enabled Roosevelt to bring in a new commissioner, John R. Proctor of Kentucky. Proctor was a tall, scholarly geologist and civil service reformer who had caught Roosevelt's eye in the spring of 1893, and whom he had then hoped, in vain, would replace silly, well-meaning Lyman. Now with Proctor in, he at last had a first-class man he could groom to take over and continue his policies as civil service commissioner. Roosevelt was beginning to talk of stepping down after one more winter in Washington, "although I am not at all sure as to what I shall do afterwards." Many writers other than Henry Adams have compared Theodore Roosevelt's career to that of an express locomotive speeding toward an inevitable destination. The simile may be extended to describe his 2 static years under President Cleveland as a mid-journey pause to stoke up with coal and generate a new head of steam. The first signs that he was about to get underway again occurred in the late summer of 1894. There was the lift of a signal, a flickering of needles, the anguish of a personal farewell, a groan of loosening brakes. From now on, Roosevelt's acceleration would be continuous, almost frighteningly so to some observers, but very exhilarating to himself. Sometime during the first week in August, Congressman Lemuel Eli Quigg of New York, an attractive, prematurely grizzled political schemer, dropped a subtle hint regarding Roosevelt's future. "What a pity it was," he sighed, "that Roosevelt was possessed of such a variety of indiscretions, fads, and animosities that it would be impossible to nominate him for mayor of New York in the fall. The odds of a Republican victory in that city were higher than they had been for years. What was more, there seemed to be a good chance of getting a reform ticket elected." Roosevelt rejected Quigg's hint good-humoredly. "I have run once." But ambition stirred within him. He had never quite gotten over his failure to capture control of his native city in 1886, and the temptation to try and transcend that failure soon became irresistible. He broached the subject with Edith, but she protested vehemently. "To run for mayor," she said, would require him to spend money they simply did not have, and the prize was by no means assured. Pitiful as his present salary was, it was at least better than the nothing he would earn as a twice-defeated mayoral candidate. Roosevelt miserably told Quigg he would have to think the matter over. On 7 August, President Cleveland recognized the new Republic of Hawaii to Roosevelt's grim satisfaction. This meant that the United States at last had a firm ally and naval base in the Pacific to counter the burgeoning might of Japan. Roosevelt had been fuming for 16 months over Cleveland's obstinate refusal to sign the annexation treaty prepared for him by President Harrison. It was a crime against the United States. It was a crime against white civilization. In his opinion, the president should now start to build up the Navy and order the digging of an interoceanic canal in Central America with the money of Uncle Sam. However, Roosevelt knew there was not much chance of that, for the Democrats were very weak about foreign policy. Cleveland does his best, but he is not an able man. On Monday, 13 August, a telegram arrived to say that Elliot Roosevelt, drinking heavily again and reunited with his mistress in New York, was very ill indeed. Roosevelt, desk-bound in Washington, did not respond. He knew from experience that Elliot would not let any members of the family come near him. There had been many such messages in recent months. He can't be helped, and he must simply be let go his own gait. The following day, Elliot, racked with delirium tremens, tried to jump out of the window of his house, suffered a final epileptic fit, and died. Distraught, Theodore hurried to New York and saw stretched out on a bed, not the bloated souse of recent years, but the handsome youth of the old time, 15 years ago, when he was the most generous, gallant, and unselfish of men. The sight shattered him. "Theodore was more overcome than I have ever seen him," Corrine reported, and cried like a little child for a long time. Theodore recovered his equanimity in time to veto the hideous plan that Elliot be buried with his wife. Instead, a grave was dug in Greenwood Cemetery, beside those who were associated only with his sweet, innocent youth. At the funeral on Saturday, Roosevelt noted with some surprise that the woman and two of her friends behaved perfectly well, and their grief seemed entirely sincere. On 4 September, he started west to shoot a few antelope and ponder the New York mayoralty. He felt depressed and ill, and Dakota's drought-stricken landscape drove him back to Oyster Bay after only 2 weeks on the range. Edith was still adamantly against him running in October, and Theodore, who was as putty in her hands, decided to turn Quigg down. But this was by no means easy. Quigg was so sure of his acceptance that a special nominating committee of 70 had been formed and was determined to nominate him as a reform candidate. He had to refuse 4 times before they would accept his decision. He sank into a mood of bitter remorse as his 36th birthday approached, for he felt himself a political failure. His whole instinct was to run. After well over 5 years of appointive office, he craved the thrill of an election campaign. At all costs, he must keep his chagrin private. "No outsider should know that I think my decision was a mistake." Henry Cabot Lodge received the terse explanation, "I simply had not the funds to run." But after a further period of brooding, Roosevelt had to unburden himself to his friend. "I would literally have given my right arm to have made the race, win or lose. It was the one golden chance which never returns. And I had no illusions about ever having another opportunity. I knew it meant the definite abandonment of any hope of going on in the work and life for which I care more than any other. You may guess that these weeks have not been particularly pleasant ones. At the time, with Edith feeling as intensely as she did, I did not see how I could well go in. Though I have grown to feel more and more that in this instance I should have gone counter to her wishes. The fault was mine, not Edith's. I should have realized that she could not see the matter as it really was, or realize my feelings. But it is one of the matters just as well dropped." William L. Strong, a middle-aged businessman with little or no political experience, was duly nominated by the Republicans of New York. He ran on a popular reform ticket and was elected. And so the mayoral campaign of 1894 joined that of 1886 as another of Roosevelt's unspoken, passionate regrets. Returning to work at the Civil Service Commission now was a little like starting to go through Harvard again after graduating, and that telltale sign of Rooseveltian frustration, bronchitis, recurred in December. For a week, he was confined to his bed. A strange tone of nostalgia for his native city crept into his correspondence as he obsessively discussed Mayor Strong's appointments and the prospects for real reforms of the municipal government. Shortly before Christmas, a message arrived from Strong. Would he care to accept